Welcome back to Brandon Wilborn's Fantasy Fiction, where fans of classic fantasy adventures can hear the serialized audiobooks of a fellow nerd and indie author completely for free. I'm your author, narrator, nerd, and host, Brandon Wilborn. Thanks for listening this week. I really appreciate it. I've got some updates I wanted to share, so the story portion of this episode starts right about the 4.5 minute mark. This is my 25th episode, which feels pretty cool to say and to have that accomplishment. I'm on the last handful of episodes before this story is complete, and it's feeling very, very close to the same feeling you get when you're about to finish a book or when you finished a book, of just that breath you can let go because it's done. I have to say what I've learned in this process is that it takes way more time and energy than I expected. The energy comes in heavy in the reading and recording phase. To give voice to these characters requires more than you would expect. I knew a little bit of that because of theater experience back in high school. I was kind of a theater geek. But then the time investment comes with editing the audio. It's certainly gotten faster, but it takes a long time. I know professionals say it's between 6 and 9 hours of work to complete an hour of professional audio. So you can kind of guess what it's taken to get this done. And I'm no pro. With my other work responsibilities, I will admit it has completely slowed me down on completing book two. There's already a novella that immediately follows The Treasure of Capric that's ready to go, and it continues the story of Captain Bacchus. But the full book two has been a slow slog just because things have changed in Pollingham, as we're beginning to see in these episodes. Since there's only so many hours in the day and even fewer that are creatively productive, the writing has just turned to a crawl. But going forward, here's what I see as my options. I could have seasons of writing and seasons of recording and doing audio and just kind of swap back and forth. As the book is done, I do the audio and vice versa. You know, that could be a decent rhythm, but I don't think it's the most efficient, and it certainly wouldn't be putting out very much content throughout the year. On the other hand, I could start using something like Patreon or Kickstarter to help fund these efforts, to fund the audio editing and the future book releases. I know some authors have gone that route and found a way to get both done. It may also mean that the audio book gets done professionally, and maybe the podcast, you know, is something that's slower to follow. Or it could just mean that somebody else takes on that slow technical aspect of editing, and then it gives me more time to write and get more recording done at the same time. That's what I would consider option two versus the seasonal approach. I know I don't have a huge audience, but I appreciate those of you who are here. And so there's risk to doing that, in that it might not earn enough to support all the work that's needed. And then running those platforms is another piece of work on its own. It's another job, practically. As a writer, the marketing side gets a little uncomfortable. So I'll just ask, what do you think would be the best option for, or as a listener or as a reader? What do you think would be the best option? Seasons of books and audio back and forth, or trying to raise support to finish the work and get more stories out into the world? I would genuinely love to hear your feedback on this. It's an important question to me, and it does affect you if you're somebody who enjoys my work. If it matters to you at all, please, please send me a message at brandonwilborn.com/contact and tell me your preference. That's brand on, not brand off, and Wilborn is as simple as you can make it. WILBORN. So the website again is brandonwilborn.com/contact. And if you're worried about leaving a long message, you could just tell me option one or option two, or you could even, there's a message option there that you can leave me a voicemail as well. Now for the recap. Last time in The Treasure of Capric, Kurian discovered why the king chose him, while Fallon made his final assault on the gates, only to be defeated and captured. This week I'll be reading from chapters 26 and 27. Now I present for your enjoyment The Treasure of Capric. Chapter 26. Gifts. As soon as he voiced his prayer, a sharp intake of breath told Kurian they were not alone. He rose and turned to see Tobin and Rhys standing in another passage, which he assumed led to the entrance of the caves. "Hi," he said breathlessly, and then cleared his throat. How long have you been standing there?
Long enough to bear witness, said the king, and moved to embrace them both. Welcome, valiant warriors.
As soon as the king released them, they thanked him, and both rushed forward to greet Kurien. Rhys grabbed both of his friends and lifted them in a great bear hug that squeezed out all of Kurien's breath.
We were worried when you disappeared,
Tobin said. Rhys offered a gruff,
Good to see you on your feet.
Where's Noman? Kurien asked, looking behind them to the tunnel.
He decided to stay behind at the camp,
Rhys said, shaking his head and cocking his eyebrows. Tobin's gaze flitted between the king and Kurien.
Is this him?
Yes, Kurien said. This is the king of the caves, my friends. The true king of Pollingham. He did not feel the need to say anything about Lord Avacius's stories of the king being a criminal. That statement eliminated them all.
And what we just saw?
Tobin tried to prompt him in his gentle way.
He was the one who showed the vision to Sage Martin. He called us all out from the Order. I have decided to answer his call and join him.
Kurien looked at the king for a moment and received a small nod.
You may come with me if you wish, or you are free to go where you please.
You know we won't leave you, Tobin said.
I told you we were still a troop,
Rhys echoed.
I had to give you the choice, Kurien said,
and then realizing why he offered it, he added,
It's the way he works.
One of the other ways that I work, said the king with a smile, is by offering gifts. I once told a story about a new set of clothes, and some of the men in camp took the allegory to heart, as you have seen.
He tugged on Tobin's new coat.
However, in this case, I shall give Alden a run for his money.
He turned away from them toward a large cabinet against the far wall and flung the doors wide. Inside were three sets of armor that gleamed in the firelight like no metal they had ever seen. Rather than reflecting, they appeared as if they cast their own glow. The silver-colored breastplates were inlaid with gold along the edges. Fine castings of noble animals and rich fruits embellished the shoulders and chest, appearing to move in the flickering shadows. Hanging above them, glinting as if gems stood out from every edge, were matching helmets that could have served as crowns for ancient kings. The king opened a second cabinet, revealing arms of equal beauty. Three swords rested horizontally on hooks. Kurien could just make out inscriptions where the blades met their hilts, written in the same arcane script as the treasure. Small kite shields leaned against the back of the cabinet, also coated in a metal that looked like still water. In the center of each was a symbol in relief. A strong, noble stag on one, the next a ferocious badger, and the last the king's own symbol. Someone had embellished the reliefs with paint, giving them a lifelike brilliance. At the bottom of the cabinet lay scabbards and belts made of fine lambskin dyed red and white, like the belts of the Caprics.
Dress quickly, said the king, for I have arranged a meeting with Avacius, and Appaford hangs in the balance.
What do you mean? Tobin asked. If we meet him wearing that, he'll think we mean to do battle.
And you must,
the king said to him, while holding out the smallest breastplate.
All rulers, however small a territory they maintain, must fight to exercise their rule, else they lose all. There is always resistance, though some must contend with arms and some in other realms. For you, I believe it will be both, or Pollingham will never be free of Avacius.
They helped each other to secure their arms and armor. Kurien thought their fighting skills would be hindered, but not useless with the armor, and he was surprised at how light it was and how much movement it allowed, as if the armor had been forged for them. He longed for the now familiar staff instead of the sword with which he had rarely practiced. Yet the sword was beautiful and deadly, and he eagerly wanted to learn its secrets. Finally, the king wrapped the treasure in thick leathers, placed it into a satchel, and led them back to the hagiary. Tobin pulled up next to Kurien in the wide passage and whispered,
Are you sure about this?
I've never been more certain of anything, Kurien smiled back. I read part of the treasure.
You did what?
Tobin nearly screamed.
He let me read it, and I found out why it is so valuable to the whole plain of Avos.
Tobin waited, speechless.
It tells of the great kings of old, and of the glorious king who will restore Finn, Kurian said, turning his head to include Rhys. And I believe that it's him. He gestured toward the king walking ahead. I'm still terrified, and I can't fully explain it, but he has my oath of allegiance. No, more than that. Now that I have seen him, I want to spend my life learning to be like him. He shrugged his shoulders. That probably sounds insane.
Not entirely, Tobin said as they stepped into the enormous round cave. I think I'm beginning to see it too, and I think all of our new friends would agree.
The king unbolted the door through which Kurian had seen the vision and then turned toward them.
Kurian, my friend, you have accepted your call, and I will leave you with this reminder. The road will be longer and more difficult than you now imagine. Do not lose hope. You do not travel alone.
He blew into his cupped hands and lifted them above Kurian's head, where he spread them out as if he were anointing him with oil, as they had the ancient kings. Kurian immediately felt all of the anxiety leave his mind and body, and he was filled with a new strength of courage and conviction to see the vision come to pass.
Go forth, King of Pollingham.
Turning to Tobin, he held out the satchel carrying the treasure.
Studious Tobin, I call you to the task of the sages.
Tobin took the bag with wide eyes. It was his secret desire, only shared in greatest confidence with Kurian.
However, said the king, I will give you a clue to their one great error. Remember the oak. How does it protect its life?
By spreading its fruit, the acorn?
Tobin asked in a moment.
Very wise and very quick. Learning its wisdom will require more time.
My king, Kurian said, are we all to protect the treasure now, as before?
Do not worry about the task assigned to him, the king said. I have put the book in here.
He pointed to Kurian's heart.
Mr. Hart will help it get in here.
He pointed to Kurian's head.
As he will help many.
He stepped to the right and faced Rhys, and his stature became rigid and formal.
Mr. Brock, I know that you do not understand all you have seen on your journey, and that you persist first because of loyalty. It is a quality that brings you honor. Use it to protect your friends well.
Is that it?
Rhys asked, looking confused.
That is all you are ready to hear. However, that does not mean you are not also called to great purpose. You will discover yours when you truly decide to join your friends. For now, stand firm in your loyalty, for it will be tested.
The king then stepped beside the open door and held out the torches to them.
This way you will find the hidden path back to the plain near Duri. A friend will meet you below.
You're not coming with us? Kurian asked.
It is not my time. Do not lose hope, Kurian, and trust that when you need it, help will come.
There was no vision within the doorway as they stepped through. Only darkness. It retreated enough for them to see the next few steps in the tunnel. No more. Kurian turned and caught a final glimpse of the king before the door shut. Then they were trotting through the blackest night he had ever known, with only the torches to find their way. Part 3. Chapter 27. Morning in Pollingham. Kurian, Rhys, and Tobin traveled through dark, narrow passages in the earth for hours. It didn't matter whether they were just below the surface of the crags of the wild goats or deep in the heart of the Northland cliffs. The three friends could not tell the difference in the dark underground. The torches miraculously endured, but their light could tell them nothing about the world beyond the stone. During the first hour, Tobin and Rhys told Kurian their story of reaching the king's camp, including his illness and disappearance. They told him of the people at the camp and of their teacher's change of heart. Tobin gave his best guess at Noman's reasons for staying behind, and Rhys recounted the siege by Captain Fallon before the king called them. He did not leave out his disappointment at missing the final action. Then Kurian told them about his time with the king, answering all their questions, mostly Tobin's, about what he had learned about Pollingham, their order, and the treasure that they now carried in a leather satchel. Eventually, their conversation died off, as if the long tunnel, pulling their voices into nothingness without any echo, also stifled their desire to speak. In the front, Kurian was the first to notice when the passage began descending rapidly, just after a sharp turn. Tobin quickly pointed out that the walls were changing from the rough, biscuit-colored sandstone to the cold, mottled gray of granite.
"We must be going down into the Northland cliffs," he said.
Kurian was quick to agree. He touched the stone where rough tool marks ran across a seam in the rock. Parts of the passage were natural, but somebody had gone to the trouble of enlarging or lengthening the tunnel for their own purposes.
"Possibly the king," he thought. "Or he could just be the latest benefactor."
It obviously made sneaking on and off the plains very simple. A slight breeze cooled his face, and he noticed that the air was fresher here.
"Could we be close to the end?" he asked.
Tobin and Rhys both shrugged, as if to say,
"How should we know? We've never been in a cave before either."
Shortly after the passage began its descent, they took the first switchback and entered a small cavern with a large hole in one wall that opened to the outside. Wind whistled past the opening, and dim light filtered through, illuminating what looked like a small sitting room. Two chairs and a table sat against the wall opposite the opening, and a metal brazier stood ready for a fire. When Kurian stepped to the edge of the natural window, he understood what it was.
"It's a lookout post," he said.
The other two stepped up to the precipice beside him.
"Very sneaky," Rhys said with an approving grin.
The edge of the cliffs dropped nearly 2,000 feet from their toes. Far below, they saw the lights of Duri off to the right, surrounded by its dark forest canopy. Before them, the plain spread like a gray-green carpet in the dim light of dawn. However, when Kurian looked up, he realized that it was not the same dawning light he had grown up with. Instead of a gradation of gray, lightening in the east but still charcoal in the west, the sky over Duri was a deep indigo. On the furthest horizon, it was almost black, like the darkest sapphire, and in it he saw a faint pinprick of light. Then a few more. Stars. They were as beautiful as he remembered, shimmering like distant gems, multiplied in their beauty by each new one he saw.
"Oh, my,"
Tobin said, breathless. Kurian followed his gaze east. The sky grew lighter in shades of blue instead of gray, from darkest sapphire to indigo, then cobalt, chalcedony, and finally the translucent liquid shade of an aquamarine. At the eastern horizon was a line so bright all color was washed away to tones of palest yellow. As they watched in silence, the line expanded, condensing into a round bump, mounding up on the horizon like a new sprout pushing up through the earth. The light intensified as it grew until it formed a half-circle with rays of piercing light bristling from it like spears. Kurian watched in wonder, suspecting what it was long before he saw that rising orb. In the east, where the light was strongest, the sky looked exactly as it had in his vision, and that could mean only one thing. This was the sun. He wasn't certain he would have recognized it before the vision, and even now it shocked him with its beauty and intensity. From so high on the cliff, the light made it seem as if he could see forever. He thought he could make out the ruins of Finn over 60 miles to the south. The horizon itself was like looking into the future. He could only imagine what the people on the plain were feeling, being the first in generations to look upon this miracle. The rays of light drifted higher, and in the moment that it topped the lip of the cave's window, it poured on their faces with full intensity, blinding their dark accustomed eyes. It was almost as bright as the moment that he woke and first saw the king, and seeing it now reminded him of everything. He suddenly understood, no, wholeheartedly believed everything the king had told him would come. This was proof, and it gave him hope. Rhys stepped into the shadow of the cave wall, rubbing his eyes. Tobin gasped.
"I feel as if I have never seen daylight until now," he said, still staring at the horizon.
"I suspect we will see many new things," Kurian said with a smile. Tobin turned to face him, and the sun reflected off his armor and flashed over Kurian's face, making him squint. The light was less intense, but still the same pure color of the sun. You shine like the sun, Tobin.
So do you, Tobin said.
Then he noticed that he also reflected the sunlight like a walking mirror. He twisted his shoulders and a beam of light flashed across Tobin's face. They both laughed. Rhys drew his polished sword and held it in the light, moving the reflected light over his friends' faces. For a few moments they were boys again with a new toy. With flashing swords they flung darts of light at each other and deflected those coming their way with their shields. A matching light show played across the walls while the boys danced around the cave in mock battle. They laughed for pure joy, as they had not done for weeks, because the exorbitant beauty of the light was as intoxicating as wine, and they drank it in like men dying of thirst. Finally, Kurian realized what they were doing and recalled their purpose. He stopped the play and let his laughter run out.
"This is good," he said, "and we needed it, but we still have a mission, and our time is running out."
"It's too bad we can't get rid of Evasius with a few glints of light," Tobin said.
"It's more fun the old-fashioned way," said Rhys, then swung his sword in his bold, passionate way.
"In any case, I suspect this new change in the world won't serve his ends," Tobin added.
"And I believe it's only the beginning of the help the king promised," Kurian said. He sheathed his own sword and glanced over the edge of the cliffs again.
"It's a long way down, and even longer to Apaford. We'd better get moving."
They found fresh torches and dashed into the dark tunnel leading down to the plains. Something was wrong with the sky. The pure black of night, which usually turned into a dirty, dim glow at morning, was changing to an ever-lightening blue, scattered with a few strange dots like far-off candles. Lord Evasius noticed them about an hour before dawn, and he almost feared that something was wrong with his eyes. White spots floated in his father's vision before he finally went blind in old age. However, this couldn't be the same thing, because his men were gazing uncomfortably at the sky as well, and as the dawn came, the specks disappeared. The eastern sky looked as if it were on fire. Was this an omen? Could it be some unnatural trick from the monks? Were they still capable of the same miracles from the story of their founding? No, these were silly doubts. If they were, their compound would still stand. He listened to the thunder of 3,000 soldiers marching or riding swiftly behind him, and thought of the other troops they would converge with soon, and the questions faded. A few weak monks would be no challenge. The show of force was merely to impress upon the people of Apaford the futility of rebellious sentiments. That message would quickly travel throughout Pollingham, and no one would dare challenge him again. The sound of hooves galloping out of cadence with the rest caught his attention, and he turned toward a sight that quelled his doubts completely. Muna was riding up the ranks toward him. Her stream of black hair whipped in the wind of the wondrously fast horse, tangling with her black robes. Only her pale face was clear in that blur. Evasius enjoyed the fearful stares in the faces of each rank she passed. She pulled up suddenly as she neared him and hailed him.
"Welcome back," he said.
He allowed her to ride next to him as she readjusted the shawl over her face.
"What do you make of this light in the east?"
"I do not know, my lord. It seems the clouds over our land have dispersed. Perhaps it is the sun."
This new possibility intrigued him.
"What might it portend?"
"I do not know, my lord," the witch repeated, bowing her head in deference. "The only methods of divination I have with me are unclear. It could be an omen, but its meaning seems to confuse the bones. If only I had returned under better circumstances, Lord Evasius."
It impressed him how quickly she regained her breath to make such a speech after riding so fast.
"How so?" he asked. "Our enemies evaded Fallon, but now when I remove their heads, I will get to see their faces myself."
"I do not know how that is possible," Muna said demurely. "I saw the monks in Whalesand. From there they crossed to Rama and into the canyons above the cliffs. I doubt they could have flown down from there."
"My other spies reported them leaving Duri and heading here. Maybe they've found the secret passage we've suspected the raiders have."
"Forgive me, Lord Evasius," Muna said with deadly severity.
but one of us was deceived. They could not have traveled almost 300 miles faster than I have.
Evasius clenched his teeth. Fallon's death was already assured, if he returned. And now the captain from Dury, along with his messenger, would also be executed. Somewhere there had to be men he could trust with leadership. If he had to kill all the incompetents to find them, so be it. He was resolved to offer them as sacrifices to his control. With luck, he might find a few worthy replacements on the current march. The prospect of a new deception from Dury settled another thing in his mind. Appiford would be terrorized today, whether the fugitives were there or not. Everyone in Pollingham needed to see he would brook no challenge to his authority. Whether the town survived depended on how quickly they surrendered the Capricks. He turned to Muna with a predator's smile.
Then let us continue and find out the truth. On second thought, perhaps I should let Muna destroy the town in some inventive way. It seems a fitting reward for their long association with the rebel monks, he thought to himself.
It's morning in Pollingham. The world is changing, but there's still a big fight waiting for our boys. Join me next Friday as the Treasure of Capric continues. Thank you again for listening to my story. I would love to hear if you have any feedback or questions or comments, or again, if you have an opinion on how I should proceed with writing and doing audio at the same time. You can send me a message or leave me a voicemail by going again to brandonwilborn.com/contact. Thanks again for listening to the show. If you're enjoying it, please give it a 5-star rating and a review, and then go ahead and share that show with your group of fantasy fans. I've heard a lot lately that most people actually find podcasts by recommendations from friends, not from an algorithm, which I kind of like. So your tip could actually help me grow and give your friends or family hours of free entertainment. That's all for this week. Until next time, Godspeed. The Treasure of Capric is available in print and ebook formats from all major booksellers. Find a link to your favorite retailer in the show description or go to brandonwilborn.com. That's brand on, not brand off, and Wilborn is as simple as you can make it. WILBORN. This has been The Treasure of Capric, Book 1 of The King of the Caves, written and narrated by Brandon M. Wilborn. Copyright Brandon M. Wilborn.